Hello, hello, my lovely patrons. Welcome to the second bonus episode, deleted scenes for Doing It Deep Dives. This one is for the second episode, which is all about disability. And so, yeah, you're going to hear some of the bits that didn't make it into the final episode from Lolo and Corey and Jenny. There's stuff about sex surrogacy, about equal marriage as it pertains to disabled people, and Lolo's red flags with dating. So I hope you enjoy. I hope you enjoyed the full episode as well. And you'll also be getting the So How Was That For You debriefs for each of the guests soon. So yeah, enjoy. Let me know what you think. Here you go. What is sex surrogacy?
Some people use sex surrogates as somebody to experience a journey with. So there's normally a start, middle, and an end. And for some people, that they've never have had any kind of sexual interaction at all. So rather than using a sex worker, a sex surrogate can work very closely with that person through their emotional journey as well as their physical journey, and there's normally an end date to that, to be able to get that person on the road to be able to start having sexual experiences of their own independently with somebody that they're not paying for that service for.
When might a disabled person seek the support of a sex surrogate, and what is the difference between like sex surrogacy and sex work?
Let's set up the scene. That person is maybe a wheelchair user. They have been in care maybe most of their lives. Goes back to that infantilization. They've never really been able to talk to anybody about having sex. Not very, you know, not ever really seen as a sexual being before. Never, had very little sex education, if any. If they have, it's probably not inclusive. And actually, what a sex surrogate can do with that person is educate. Educate what sex looks like. And as we know, it's not just penetrative sex. So, and actually answer questions, have those conversations, you know, get over a lot of that internalized ableism that we spoke about, those internalized barriers, and work closely with that person. And most people that I've ever worked with that use sex surrogates and sex workers, to be fair, their end game has always been the same. We want to be in a loving, intimate relationship. Now, I know that's not the case for everybody, but certainly the people that we've worked with, that has been the case. And people who use sex surrogates saying, I want to be able to have the confidence to go out and meet people. Now, that's all very well, you know, very well said. But again, if you're in a care setting, and you're in an electric wheelchair, say, and you've got very, you know, maybe you've got communication impairment and your speech is really difficult for people to understand, but you have all those sexual feelings, that's an incredibly difficult place to be. So working with a sex surrogate can, a lot of the time, people are helping build up that confidence as well, and actually can quite often work with the care, if the care home are open to that, work with the care home and say, look, this is what we're talking about, this is what we're going through, this is, you know, can we start putting those things in place? So it's much more than normally sex workers normally don't build up that rapport, don't have that ongoing, you know, relationships, quite a psychological thing as well, and normally go in, you know, do what they do, and then come out again, which is fine. There's absolutely a place for that as well, but the two are normally seen as quite different strands of, you know, professionalism, for want of a better word. And it's like any good counsellor, right, should be like, we want to get you to not see me anymore. You know, it's the same as a good sex surrogate. It's like, actually, there's an end date to this, so I don't have to be here anymore. So that's exactly it. It should be some kind of end date.
What does inclusive sex education look like to you?
If you open a book and everybody in there is all white, they're all standing, you know, and if you're all female, and they're all male, you'd go, wait a minute, this clearly isn't about me, because well, that's not, that doesn't look like me, you know. And so even from the very basics, the visuals, the pictures, you know, if we aren't even just looking and seeing, and representation of disability, again, it's not always a wheelchair. We know that it's in fact a small percentage. But sometimes even having that, disabled people who have hidden disabilities, to the language that is used, and again, it being inclusive language, not othering, to even sometimes the font that is used, you know, to the is it accessible in British Sign Language? There's so many things to it, but actually, what's really important is the sex educators themselves understand, and they have had training. We work quite closely with Split Banana, and I think they're brilliant because they wanted to learn, they wanted to be taught by us. You know, how do we make lessons inclusive for people? If somebody has a communication impairment that's in our class and they're really struggling to ask a question, how do we go about that? If somebody has is using a communication aid, for example, and they want to have these conversations, how do we do that? And actually, that's an even more complicated answer, because if somebody has a communication aid, that information has to be put in that communication aid for someone, right? But you can't talk about sex and you can't talk about masturbating and all those things if somebody hasn't programmed those words in for you. How are you going to do it? Right? So actually, it again goes all the way back to educating non-disabled people, going, you need to be putting those words in. You need to be putting, giving these people the tools to be able to have these conversations. And also inclusive sex education. We, you know, with sex education, you don't talk about pleasure. Pleasure isn't really spoken about, and I understand why, but also, therefore, pain isn't really spoken about. And it comes back to that. Suddenly, all these disabled, particularly women, we know disabled women are 3 times more likely to be sexually abused. Why are we putting ourselves through that? Because we're trying to be the norm, you know, we're trying to do that. And oh, wait a minute, this is painful. Maybe it's meant to be painful. So actually, even if it's the subtleties of sex education, saying actually, if you have a condition and it is painful, or your position, you know, or you're getting cramp, or you're spasming, or whatever it is. And lastly, it's whether we're talking about sex education, maybe not just in schools, but up, you know, occupational therapists, amazing. They're like my best friends, you know. I'll go to them and go, so and so's having, we've had a, you know, we've had somebody phone in from the Love Lounge. They're spasming a lot. They want to have penetrative sex. It is important to them. Everyone keeps saying it's not important, but it is important to them. What do we do? And then an occupational therapist might say, and especially our resident Kat, she's amazing. What about using a soft spreader bar that person can use with padding? Brilliant. So go and feed that back. Then I get an email, you know, a week later, oh my God, we've managed to have penetrative sex. You know, so wow, that's amazing. So that's sex education. You know, that's educating people how to be inclusive and getting OTs and people in, you know, thinking laterally about things. So there's a lot of work to be done because it's very sporadic how inclusive it is around the country.
Because of a lot of the stigma and these myths that there is around disabled people that we've kind of been talking about, do you have any advice for people navigating dating and relationships when they're going to be faced potentially with a lot of that stuff?
First of all, you need to have a person. You need to have someone. I mean, you don't need to. You can date, and if you're really just totally on your own, but having someone who's that person you can talk to, who is going to get it and is going to listen, is invaluable. I think it's also just important for us to know that we don't owe anyone our stories. We don't owe any, like, it's about boundaries, right? That, like, as a disabled person, you don't have to tell someone anything about your body yet, right? I mean, so if you're going on a date, you don't owe anyone anything other than a date and being polite and trying to get along or whatever, and then ending it if you're not. But, you know, you don't have to disclose, this is how I move through the world, or this is a word that gets used, this is a diagnosis I was ever given. That is not anyone's right to know. And of course, people will ask, and you can just say, that's that's private, and that's something maybe I'll talk to you about later, but not now. That's the other thing, is like, just because a space makes you feel unwelcome doesn't mean you don't have a right to be there, right? And I guess let me say this one last thing is also, you absolutely also have the right to withdraw, right? So saying like, I can't, I mean, and many of my friends, I mean, I don't know anyone who doesn't do this, which is like, they'll date for a while, and if they don't find a partner, then they'll just stop for a while because it is so exhausting on so many levels. So knowing that that's fine, that that's not a failure, that that's just you taking care of yourself.
One thing that I learned recently that is a thing that happens in the UK is about how if you are disabled and you're getting disability benefits from the government, if you then choose to marry, you would then lose said benefits. And this seems to be something that in some way, shape or form exists in other countries like in the US and Canada. What is going on there? Why?
It's about the idea that if you are going to be disabled in the eyes of the government, that you must be, you can't be anything else. Right. So you can't be a worker because it's not, let me say, so first of all, this is absolutely true for marriage. And this was a real sticking point for all of us during the marriage equality fight in the United States, when literally they would be saying, everyone should have the right to be married. And it's like, well, you're not fighting for that, because they absolutely did not talk about disabled people at all in their fight to get gay marriage legalized. So, so marriage for all, marriage equality, it's not what we have. So it's partly this idea that like you are beholden to us. You can only be this one thing, which is nothing, right? We will give you not really enough to live on, but tell you it's enough to live on, and you can't do anything. And also, of course, the lack of imagination of anyone making these laws, thinking that disabled people would want to get married to each other, or even live together and become common law, be sexual partners, right? So there's this idea that disabled people and also older people in that example aren't having sex. So why would we need to accommodate anything around that? This is also the case in areas of employment, right? So here I can just speak to Canada. If you're receiving benefits, disability benefits from an insurance company, you're not allowed to work, even if you can, right? So again, there's this idea of like, well, if you're disabled, you can't do anything. But of course, so I'm thinking of a friend of mine who's an academic who, you know, loves working and figured out, and you know, her disability means she's quite debilitated. So all sorts of things need to be adapted. But she basically figured a way she could continue to do her work. And she was told, no, if she tried to do that work, she would lose her disability benefits, which in her case would mean she would die because she would rely on medication that is not affordable at all. So we see this in lots of different areas, and it's completely messed up, right? Because again, like, so it means, and again, this is how, this is how it makes it sound like it's intentional, but this is one of the ways that disabled people, again, are kept apart from each other, right? Because if you're disabled and you have a non-disabled partner and maybe they make enough money, then maybe you can get married because maybe you don't need to rely on your benefits. But if you're disabled and your partner's disabled and you both rely on benefits, you know, often you can't do it. You can't live together because of common law. So, you know, you could live together for, I guess, a short period of time. So I would like to hope that this is something that will change.
One of the things that I find really quite insidious and scary about the example that you gave, where it's a disabled person and a non-disabled person who like has enough money to support everyone, is that then the disabled person becomes financially dependent on their partner. And we know that rates of abuse and sexual violence are higher in terms of like the disabled person being a victim or survivor of that. And so it's correct. Just, yes. It then exacerbates that problem.
Yeah, yeah. It's all bad.
What are like some of your red flags or green flags that you look out for in this vetting process?
So some of the red flags that I look out for in my kind of like dating or sex partner process is whether or not they have a friend group. And it's important because if you are part of a friend group, I feel like it is a sign that people enjoy your presence. People enjoy being around you. People feel safe being around you. And those kinds of things. So if you don't really have a friend group, and again, the friend group doesn't have to be large. It could be you and three other friends, but if you guys are tight, then that's a good sign to me. Now, if you're like, nah, I really don't, I no new friends, I don't do friends, that's a red flag to me. Because why are you trying to disassociate from humanity? I don't like that. Not a fan. I would say another kind of like flag or red flag that I pay attention to is whether or not they dismiss that I have a disability. And whether it's this, oh, ain't nothing wrong with you, I can still handle you. Oh, you're thinking about it too much. No, it's going to be fine. And it's like, no, I'm telling you this for a reason. This is important. So if you dismiss my needs surrounding my disability, that is a huge red flag. Or just my needs as a woman, period. It's like, nah, I got this. You know, that ego, ugh, I don't like that. Another red flag I would say would be how that person treats other people that they don't know, like complete strangers. If they're just like a dick, they're an asshole, they're just like they don't tip at restaurants or something like that.
How have your experiences been dating in general as a disabled Black woman? And also, what advice would you have for other people who are navigating that whole thing?
I would say my experiences as a disabled Black woman dating has been a hosh-posh of a little bit of everything. I've, you know, been ghosted. I've been told straight to my face, I don't want to do this. I've done toxic. I've done really great and healthy relationships. I've done open relationships.
You ticked all the boxes.
Done it all. I ticked all the boxes. But I would say overall, the experience has been challenging. And I think more so challenging because in order for me to have gotten to a healthy place in a dating process, I had to do a lot of self-work. It's really the most important thing to do is to really not let statistics, society, and all of the things define what your experiences should be. And, you know, I've been told to my face from an ex, oh, well, I'll just go get me an able-bodied girl. Like, shit like that. Please go get the bitch, because I'm tired of you right now too. Like, what are we talking about? You know? And it's, I've had it where, you know, my disability was weaponized against me to make me feel smaller, to belittle me, to make me feel less worthy and all of the things. So my advice would just be to be so, like, as my favorite rapper, rest in peace, Nipsey Hussle, would say, like, stay 10 toes down in what you believe in and what you believe the experiences you should have as just a human. But more importantly, if you're a Black woman with a disability and you have all of the things stacked up against you, we have to believe in ourselves that much more than anyone else, that this is the life that we deserve, which is life partnership, someone who loves us unconditionally, someone who genuinely wants to support us, and not just like in an emotional way, but in a physical way as well. Like, it matters. So it's about that self-love, that self-worthiness work across the board. And when we really believe that within ourselves, the energy shifts and you start to attract the right people into your life.
I think that like gradual process as well of like not being all in at the beginning is just a part of getting to know somebody, because everybody's got stuff. And getting to know that person is about, do I like this person? Do I want to be around their stuff?
But because it's disability. And I feel like because our stuff is more of a, in a lot of cases, life or death situation, that responsibility on a partner is felt 10 times more strongly. This is why we have to, quote unquote, normalize, and whatever normal even means, but normalize and see the humanity within disability, because what a lot of people don't know, especially if they're dating people who aren't or have never came across disability culture, is that there are solutions for these things, and solutions that aren't even that drastic. You know, like they're just, it's like, these are just really easy solutions to come up with and to be innovative about. So again, it is definitely a process, but it's way more common to allow a person, especially if they're the non-disabled partner, to grow and gradually become more and more comfortable or confident in being with the person with the disability.
Yeah. And I think there's also that, like, navigating a potential dynamic of being a romantic and a sexual partner, but then also maybe having to sometimes fulfill a role of carer, and that being like, okay, what role am I in now? How can I still show up for you as an equal romantic sexual partner in this relationship, but also I need to be your carer here as well. And one of the things that always makes me think of as well is like, isn't it a privilege? And like, you'd be so lucky to live so long that you eventually have to clear up your partner shit. Like, because you're growing old,
literally,
right?
Like, literally.
Dream scenario, you become each other's carers, you know?
Literally, that's what everybody is like aspiring to be, is like finding that person that when they get old enough and can't take care of themselves or whatever the case is, that there is somebody there that's still gonna love you as an old person. And it's kind of like, well, let's just kind of rewind that and just like, let's start it at 36. See how you like that, you know? And I, again, you know, I've been told in certain relationships that it's a feeling of greater sacrifice being involved with a person with a disability, and not from just a caregiving standpoint, but the ability to experience certain things, you know, because we know that the world isn't accessible 100% across the board. So it's like, if we want to go to freaking Bali, what does that really look like when you're a wheelchair user? What does that mean? You know, so it's like, what, now we can't go to Bali together? Well, that fucking sucks. And honestly, as a disabled person, having grace for the person trying to navigate it as best as they can, because they have to unlearn and decondition what they've learned about disability up until the point of meeting you.
We can't separate ableism from capitalism, because the decisions around whose bodies are considered worthy and valuable are connected to capitalism, as you just said, right? So who can produce? And it's interesting because, of course, if you know anything about the world of porn, actually, lots of disabled people can make money in porn, because in fact, there is a market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, because like, disabled people are the world's largest minority. Like, stats are around like 10% of people. Like, that's a huge market right there. Capitalism needs to get on that, baby.
I think I know. People feel like seeing me and seeing how I've shown up for disability representation is a very refreshing take on what they've been conditioned to believe disability lifestyle looks like and how it's experienced. I've gotten so much love from people who are disabled, and equally so much love from people who are non-disabled, saying how much they resonate with the characters that I've played before, how much they can relate to my experiences that I talk about on social media, even though they don't have a disability. You know, I get a lot of reactions from mothers and parents saying like, I'm so happy that you're here. Like, I feel like people are just so excited when they see me.
So you do training of various different professionals, so like doctors and physiotherapists and stuff, when it comes to understanding sex, but also disability and sex. And I was wondering, what is like the main thing that you feel like there is a lack of understanding of amongst those professionals that you're trying to help them gain understanding in?
So most non-disabled professionals, rehab professionals, so that's like physiotherapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists, doctors, social workers, most of them still think that there's disabled people and there's non-disabled people, and that if they're non-disabled, they are part of the non-disabled people group. So really, you know, it's a big challenge because their training is in medicine often, and they often, I guess, you know, they also think that they're expert, that what's important about them is they have this knowledge. And disabled people are, you know so much, often so much more about their bodies and minds and how they work than the medical providers who are providing them, especially those of us who are people who live with kind of rarer disabilities. So part of what I'm always telling these professionals is actually what is helpful and healing is you. If you can be in the room with a person and be human and listen and figure out like, well, what is it that they want and how can you help them? What can your knowledge do to support their goals? That is very useful. And everything else is often kind of harmful. Like one of my friends, I think she was like, and she's like very high up. She's a psychologist. She specializes in sex and disability. She's a wheelchair user. I mean, she's a very empowered person. And I think it was, she was in her 40s the first time she had a visibly disabled medical provider. And I think she said she cried a little bit. Like it was so nice for her, right? And of course, whatever. I mean, you can also have a disabled person who's a jerk and very into the medical model. But in this case, this person wasn't that. But so that's also what we need, right? We need more disabled people getting into all these different roles because that's going to be the kind of change we need.